quantity doesn't mean quality, meaning that he might have a lot of acreage, but it's low value in oil development, so that means nothing to us.
Alaska's congressional delegation reacts to the updated plan for the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskan foods make an appearance in school lunches.
It's really good. It seems like it's more like actual real food than maybe some of the other things they serve.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is one step closer to finalizing a management plan for the National Petroleum Reserve on Alaska's North Slope. Salazar signed off today on a preferred alternative for the reserve and release the full details on what's included in the plan. The proposed plan splits 23 million acres, roughly 50-50, between protected areas and land available for oil leasing. Bud Cribley, State Director for the Bureau of Land Management, which oversees NPRA, says the plan is designed to answer one basic question.
How can we best allow for the development of oil and gas resources and also the construction of infrastructure to support offshore development in a balanced manner to both meet the needs from the administration of promoting energy development while still protecting the natural resource values in the National Petroleum Reserve?
The plan also allows for potential construction of a pipeline that could carry oil drilled from offshore wells in the Arctic Ocean. That was a point Salazar highlighted when he announced the preferred plan in August in Anchorage.
The preferred alternative also allows for the possibility of a pipeline and infrastructure to be built across the NPRA to accommodate potential future offshore oil production in the Chukchi Sea. Any such proposal, of course, would be subject to a comprehensive environmental analysis and a separate decision-making process as required by law. There is no route yet that has been proposed at this point in time.
But oil companies and other pro-development groups say those assurances are not enough. Robert Dillon is the communications director for Senator Murkowski on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. He says the plan makes it nearly impossible for a company to economically build a pipeline through the NPRA. Dillon says the plan essentially creates a pipeline corridor that crosses specifically designated areas, areas that would require extra environmental reviews.
Future reviews of a pipeline application could require that pipeline to avoid those areas completely, which means you wouldn't have a direct route, or, you know, to go through extra mitigation efforts that are going to increase the cost of a pipeline. You know, all of this could eventually make a pipeline infeasible.
The final assessment will be released after a minimum review period of 30 days. Dillon says that plan needs to include an explicit call for a feasible pipeline. Bud Cribley with BLM says he does think it's possible to build an economically viable pipeline, and Senator Mark Begich agrees. He says if not, he's prepared to find a legislative solution.
If it is commercially viable to develop Chukchi and Beaufort, then there's going to be a pipeline, hell or high water.
Interior Secretary Salazar says the areas designated for development cover 72% of the estimated recoverable oil in the reserve. But Begich is concerned not enough land is available for oil and gas leasing. He says he intends to press the case with Salazar during the review period.
Some will say, well, there's a lot of land already available in the NPRA. Well, yeah, but, you know, quantity doesn't mean quality, meaning that you might have a lot of acreage, but it's low value in oil development, so that means nothing to us.
Environmental groups offered praise for the management plan. Audubon Society President David Yarnold says this plan proves that sound energy policy and conservation can go hand in hand. The plan protects environmentally sensitive areas such as bird habitat around Teshekpuk Lake. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says it has no timetable for completing its review of the impacts of large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region. The agency released a draft watershed assessment in May and had hoped for a final report as early as year's end. EPA said today that it's updating the assessment in response to more than 230,000 public comments and comments from a peer review panel. EPA said it hasn't set a new timeline for completing its work. The assessment stemmed from concerns about developing a large copper and gold prospect near the headwaters of Bristol Bay. EPA has said the study isn't about one project, like the proposed Pebble Mine. The study was criticized by pro-development groups, the state, and others, who called EPA's actions premature and an overreach. Doyon is seeking permits to mobilize for oil and gas exploration work in the Yukon Flats and Nenana Basin. The permits for cross-country travel are out for public comment. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Yukon Flats project involves another round of seismic survey near Stevens Village. Doyon Vice President for Lands and Natural Resources Jim Mary says the Interior Regional Native Corporation is looking at two different plans for accessing its area lands.
The simple option is to fly everything in, which is what we did before in our earlier program. But we're also investigating the option of an ice road up the Yukon River. This has been done before when an airport was reconstructed a few years ago. It's an option which we're taking a hard look at.
Mary says the proposed 29-mile ice road is cheaper than flying in equipment and supplies, a savings that can also lower the cost of living for Stevens Village's 40 to 50 residents this winter. He says if Doyon gets the state travel permit, a decision on the road will hinge on whether ice thickness is enough to handle heavy loads, including fuel trucks hauling up to 5,000 gallons. Mary says mobilization scheduled for the third week of January is for a work camp that will employ about 90 people, including some locals.
Last time we were there, a much smaller program, we were able to employ somewhere between 18 and 20 local folks or people connected with Stevens Village. Some of them may reside here in Fairbanks now, but with strong local connections. And we hope to improve upon that significantly in this project.
The goal of the seismic project is to identify oil and gas exploration drill targets. Doyon is a little further along on similar work near Nenana, where the corporation has leased 400,000 acres from the state. It drilled an exploration well in 2009 that did not yield a commercially viable deposit, but Mary says optimism remains high about the area.
We gathered a lot of very valuable information about potential source rock in the basin, the well that we drilled was on a seismic line, and other work that we've done out there subsequently shows us that that there could be hydrocarbons located on the western side of the basin, and so that's where we're going to go look next.
Mary says permits to construct a 7-mile road are pending with the state to access the drill site.
The road will be an extension of part of the road that we built to the Nunavak number 1 well, and so it will be along a right-of-way primarily owned by the city of Nenana.
Drilling is scheduled to take place next summer. Doyon's Nenana and Stevens Village exploration projects are part of a $37 million oil and gas plan approved by Doyon's board of directors earlier this year. The projects are eligible for state frontier basin tax credits. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka High School wood shop tests local young growth timber.
It's really me conducting the experiment of how this wood is as a teaching material, and the kids just got nice nightstands.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
It looks like Petersburg area voters have approved the formation of a borough, but the count is not yet final. The mail-in election wrapped up yesterday. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
State Elections Director Gail Fanumiai released the unofficial results on Tuesday, shortly after the Petersburg post office had closed and the deadline had been reached for the mail-in vote.
Well, we counted 1,068 ballots for the Petersburg Borough Incorporation election, and the question on whether or not to incorporate yes is at 584 and no is at 476.
That's about 55% of voters in favor of forming a borough and just under 45% who said no. By Tuesday's postmark deadline, the unofficial count showed the state had received ballots back from about 41% of eligible voters. More ballots are expected to arrive in the mail over the coming days. For instance, in-person voting was still available at the Petersburg City Council chambers up until the close of business Tuesday, and that resulted in about 70 more ballots. If the unofficial results hold, City Mayor Mark Jensen will be the borough mayor, and Petersburg will have its first borough assembly meeting in early January.
I guess it could still change, but if you look at the percentages, I think it looks like the borough initiative is going to pass. And, you know, you're aware of my position on it. I think it's a good thing for us, the region. I just hope that the numbers grow.
The newly incorporated borough government would have a broader tax base and planning authority over an area of land and sea that's about 83 times the size of the current city boundaries. Proponents say a borough government would also give the community more say in environmental and resource development issues. Jensen and other candidates for borough office ran unopposed on the ballot. Under state rules, they had to file financial disclosure forms with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. That may be partly why there are still several empty seats to appoint, including two spots on the borough assembly. Jensen is hopeful people will step up despite the APOC rules.
I hope that people will take the initiative to get the paperwork into APOC that they need to fill those vacancies. And I don't know. I hope the people that were against the borough will try to get involved and we can all move forward in a positive direction.
Borough opponents have raised concerns about more taxes with no new services and the potential for more regulations and government control in areas that currently have no municipal authority. They've also been critical of the city's borough planning process. Tom Reinhartz was among them.
I guess I have to say I'm disappointed. Obviously, I was one of those opposed to the borough as it was presented in the petition. The voters decide, and the voters decided, and it is disappointing, but I hope that from here on out there is a healing process and we all roll up our sleeves and find a way to work together and make it successful for everybody.
Reinhartz is a city councilor in Kuprnoff, which has opposed its inclusion in the borough. The small community of about 30 people is just across the Wrangell Narrows from Petersburg. Under the borough charter, Kuprnoff would remain a city and retain its own local planning powers. The borough will also incorporate a number of other neighborhoods, residences, and businesses that are now outside Petersburg. The population would include an estimated 3,300 people total, about 10% more than the current city. The new boundaries would encompass Petersburg's home island of Mitkoff, as well as Wawodski to the south and about half of Kuprnoff Island to the west. It also includes the mainland territory from Lakanti Bay up to Holcomb Bay, just south of the Juneau borough boundary. The city and borough of Juneau submitted a petition to annex some of that same territory, and it's mounted a legal challenge over the issue. The city of Cake on western Kuprnoff Island also objected to Petersburg's boundaries, but unlike Juneau, Cake did not file a competing petition. The Division of Elections plans to do another vote count on December 28th and once more on January 2nd before it certifies the Petersburg election on January 3rd. I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Salmon and halibut are being added to school lunch menus more frequently across Alaska as schools look for healthier and more local foods for kids. In August, Juneau schools received a state grant to help fund Alaska-grown lunches, a program that is likely to continue next year. Governor Sean Parnell has proposed $3 million to extend the Nutritional Alaskan Foods for Schools grant for another year. And if legislators agree, all 54 Alaska school districts would be eligible to apply. As KTOO's Kelsey Gabrowski reports, the Juneau School District already plans to expand the lunch program, but for now, students, staff, and suppliers are still getting used to the new meals.
Students flood the hallways as lunch starts at Thunder Mountain High School. They congregate at the lunch line, speeding through so they can sit and socialize. Most choose pizza or a cheeseburger, but 18-year-old Alora Pilgrim picks up halibut with broccoli and red potatoes.
I usually get a sandwich or a salad, or if there's something that looks especially yummy, like the halibut, I'll get that. It's really good. It seems like it's more like actual real food than maybe some of the other things they serve.
Pilgrim plans to major in biology after high school. When she learned the halibut and potatoes come from Alaska, she said she likes eating a lunch that's better for the environment.
I like eating food that's local and sustainable. I think it's really good because it does help our economy, and it's nice because other things that we do have to fly in are maybe not so fresh, like fruits and vegetables.
The day's halibut came from Taku Smokeries in Juneau, and the Matanuska Susitna Valley potatoes came from Anchorage-based Charlie's Produce. Earlier this fall, the Juneau School District offered sockeye salmon from Taku and a coleslaw mix from the Mat-Su. It also shipped in vegetables from Amy Doherty's Merriweather Farms in Gustavus.
We literally purchased all her carrots and sugar snap peas.
Adrienne Schwartz is the food services supervisor for the Juneau School District. She learned this year that Juneau schools were eligible for an approximately $86,000 one-time state grant that would pay for local foods and school lunches.
Our main resource in our state, I believe, has a lot to do with fishing, and any way that we can help maintain that or promote, I think is really good. And why not be purchasing foods that are grown right here in our state rather than ordering from elsewhere if we can?
Schwartz says parents and staff praise the new options, and the district plans to survey students. The menu notes when a food is from Alaska, and kitchen employees provide more details when students ask. Schwartz says the cost for a local meal is the same as any school lunch. Not everyone is a fan, though. 18-year-old Catherine Ray sits without a lunch at a table with other students. She has not tried the Alaska fish when it's available.
No, that sounds gross.
But Ray may have to get used to the new menu. The Alaska grant is just one facet of a changing lunch program. The Nutritional Alaskan Foods in Schools grant is available to other school districts. Scott Ruby is Community and Regional Affairs Director in the State Commerce, Community, and Economic Development Department. His Anchorage-based division administers the grant. Ruby says it's important that Alaska be as self-sufficient as possible.
It's called food security, where we can provide our own and not be reliant on shipping in food from outside. It's a good deal.
If the state legislature approves extending the grant next year, Ruby says each district would be eligible for the same amount of money as last year. Schools purchase the food from Alaska suppliers and then apply to the division to be reimbursed. The farm-to-school program in the Department of Natural Resources reaches out to suppliers and school districts.
And I think that's been one of the larger benefits of this, is that there were products out there that were available that were reasonable costs that school districts didn't know were available.
Ruby says the Pribilof School District even purchased Alaska-grown honey. The grant pays to process donated fish, and the state lets schools accept some donated game. This is not the first time Alaska schools have provided local food, but the funding allows for a more comprehensive and long-term effort. In Juneau, I'm Kelsey Gabrowski.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The Sitka High Wood Shop is involved in an experiment to learn if young growth timber can be made into high-end furniture and other products. One of three class sections is using locally harvested and milled alder in their projects. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
For decades, the story of timber on the Tongass was about old growth and pulpwood. When the Obama administration took office in 2009, that story started a new chapter as Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced a transition framework for the entire Forest Service. Scott Harris is with the Sitka Conservation Society.
The transition vision is to move away from a dependence on old growth logging to try to look at more multiple use and variable uses of the forest. For example, young growth, restoration, recreation, supporting salmon fisheries, things like that.
The Sitka Conservation Society has been active in developing watershed restoration projects on Prince of Wales Island at Sitka Bay and beginning next year on Kruzoff Island in Sitka Sound. Recently, the organization applied for a $10,000 grant from the National Forest Foundation to build capacity in second growth timber. A couple of prior log cabin projects have both been well received. Harris says SCS wanted to try something else.
We successfully got a grant and we said, well, let's see if we can find a really high-end use for young growth that could potentially help us, you know, develop that responsible relationship with our environment.
It doesn't matter very much to me what the wood itself is, as long as it's relatively easy for kids to use. So I'd love to buy it locally if I possibly could.
Randy Huey teaches wood shop at Sitka High. The Sitka Conservation Society bought his beginning woodworking students 1,800 board feet of Pacific red alder for their fall semester projects, enough to make about 100 nightstands.
The monetary aspects of this whole experiment are probably the bigger questions, but I don't know anything about that. It's lovely wood, and it's been a successful project. It has some challenges that poplar does not have, in that it has more knots, more tendency to cup, split, warp, check. Some of those defects may have to do with milling and drying processes and not just purely within the wood.
The alder was harvested at False Island, about 35 miles north of Sitka, by a contractor who brought the wood back to town in the round, milled it, and dried it in a small kiln he set up. Scott Harris says this was the most challenging part of the project. The grant was intended to help build capacity in young growth, but it also revealed a few shortcomings. Building real capacity will likely take a much more substantial investment. Randy Huey says everyone was learning as they go, and that doesn't change the fact that the alder is beautiful wood. His beginning woodworkers didn't really dwell much on where the materials came from. They're still learning how to use shop tools safely and how to measure within 1/16th of an inch.
We had two classes using poplar and one class using the locally milled alder. So it's really me conducting the experiment of how this wood is as a teaching material. And the kids just got nice nightstands.
Besides alder, there is money in the grant to buy locally milled spruce and hemlock, which Huey says will be used by his advanced carpentry students to construct a timber frame bike shelter for the Sitka Sound Science Center. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
We all know that growing up can be tough. The pressure to fit in can be overwhelming. So can the feeling of isolation when you don't. Last year, 16-year-old Veronica Nelson took a class at Sitka's alternative school called Strong Women that took her on a journey of self-discovery. KCAW's Anne Bryce has her story. For parents, some of the themes discussed in this piece may be unsuitable for very young listeners.
Veronica Nelson is in 11th grade at Sitka's alternative school, Pacific High. Last year, she took a course called Strong Women. In the class, they discussed stereotypes women deal with, and how to be there for each other. Nelson says since the class, she's seen many of the girls relax and be more comfortable with who they are.
The harsh words and the constant jealousy and battle, I've seen that just completely drain away since last year. I saw everybody dressing up when they wanted to dress up, not dressing up every day because they felt like they had to look better than everyone else.
Each student in the class defined what it meant to her to be a strong woman. Nelson says women should be able to do any job they want, like be a firefighter or a high-powered executive, without feeling pressure to act like a man.
Not being afraid to use her voice, not being afraid to fight for what she thinks is right, and also being able to embrace other women around her and not constantly feel the need to compare herself or feel protective of herself around other women. I think that that's a strong woman for me, and that's what I strive for.
Nelson is in a leadership group at school and says they want to teach younger kids the power of honesty and self-acceptance.
Some of us want to go to like the junior highs and the elementary schools that were in the class last year, and we've talked about going and talking to the girls there and asking them what a strong woman is to them. And seeing what they have to say, I think it'd be adorable to hear like a third grader's view of what a strong woman is and just build on that and, you know, teach them how not to be afraid to talk about certain things, you know, and if you can't talk to your parents about it, then pick a woman you can talk to about it, your teacher, your counselor, or just someone who's close to your family. And it's really important because not only are you being a leader for other people, you're being a leader for yourself. And if you can't stand up for yourself, who can you stand up for?
But Nelson says there was a time when she didn't speak up, when she feels she should have.
I started using and drinking when I was around 11 or 12, and I was raped when I was 13, when I was living down south. I had never talked about it. I thought that it was okay. I thought that it was nothing. I thought it was normal. I thought it happened to everyone when they were too drunk to defend themselves. Ever since I spoke up, I am so comfortable with being who I am and with talking about what happened to me.
And it was just last year when she broke her silence.
I think it was either during or just before the strong women's class was happening to my grandparents and to the lady I was living with. After that, it was like I could just talk about anything and just feel happy and comfortable. And I'm going, why didn't I speak up for myself when I was 13? Why? And it was because everything was so hush-hush. You don't talk about these things. You don't do that. And it's just not something you talk about.
Since she spoke up, Nelson says her peers feel more comfortable talking about their experiences too.
After speaking up about that, more girls in the class started speaking up about things that had happened to them. I think that's when I started really realizing that all we have is each other. Like if we're holding back all these things that happened to us and we're not sharing that we know what someone else is going through, then, you know, we're causing them to hold things inside of them.
Nelson is inspired by the strength she's discovered in herself and interested in inspiring others. She's taking a filmmaking class at Pacific High, where she's making a video about drug and alcohol abuse in Sitka. It's the story of her life as a recovering addict and as a strong woman. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Kelly Gabrowski in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey and Ann Bryce in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.